the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. Rest in piss to all my ops. Hello, sneaker fans in the United States and Newfoundland. This is episode 31 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. I am your host, Sock Jig, and you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram as well at Sock Jig. Right up front, I wanted to say thank you to everyone who bought the last pair of socks that I dropped. As I've said before, your support keeps this podcast going. It makes me want to create more. It really does mean a lot to me that you guys take the time to want to support, you know, to tag me on Twitter and on Instagram as well. You know, I love seeing that stuff. Thank you so much. For today's episode, there's a few topics I wanted to talk about, and I realized that if I waited too long, they would get a little bit too stale. So I figured I should get this out sooner. I talk about what happened on Twitter with the trophy room thing and how that all blew up again. And really, I give a kind of a short recap on that, but really end up talking more about the response to that. And that leads to me talking about Complex and giving credit and me kind of, you know, gatekeeping the gatekeepers. I also talk about the Kobe 6 drop and the dilemma of hype charity shoes. And then I have this lawsuit corner recap where I talk about Mischief lawsuit and why I think, you know, that test of does it look like Vans from across the street is a shitty test and shouldn't be used to set precedents in a court of law. I touch on Nike's lawsuit with La La Land and John Geiger as well. But really, I kind of move into this, shadow war that John Geiger's had with Nike sneaker designers themselves. And that led to my final topic, which is about how the era of the big name Nike sneaker designers is over and my theories on why. Overall, I try to keep the recap parts short and, you know, more heavier on thoughts and analysis. You know, the way the sneaker game is, you do have to do the recap. I know everyone is not up on every single topic, on every single story, on what's going on Twitter and on, you know, Instagram itself. Another disclaimer, I realized afterwards throughout this podcast, I may use the term getting over, and I've used this term on this podcast before, and it comes from pro wrestling, and it usually means just, you know, getting popular and accepted by the crowd. You're over with the crowd. You try to get over. That's where it comes from. I might have said putting someone over, that means when someone helps you, when someone's trying to elevate you and lift you up, so that's just a term that's a very useful shortcut term that I wish was more mainstream in popular culture, but it is not. So, but first, on feet, pickups, and skips and misses. On feet recently, nothing really crazy or anything. I've been wearing the Stash Spiridons, and I also got my Chlorophyll Trainer 1 mids in hand, and I've been wearing those as well. So for pickups, I picked up the New Balance, you know, Teddy Santis 990 V2. I missed out on the V3, but I got the consolation prize V2. I also picked up the New Balance 550 Burgundy and with cyan hints. I like that one a lot, and it's basically like retail even on GOAT. So I picked it up for retail shipped free, so tax-free, free shipping, so glad to get that. I don't have in hand yet, so I'll get it handed soon. I also picked up the Chocolate Dunk High. I got that on Livestock, and it was kind of sitting on Livestock, but I think that was because they limited it to Canada only, and I don't think it sells for too much over retail anyways. I also got the Jordan 11 7210 Lows in hand, and those released early on Nike Canada, and I put them on feet, and I just kind of instantly regretted it because they really do crush your pinky. Maybe I should go up a half size. I used to wear 11 lows all the time, like Concords or Super Beaters, and I don't think I can do it. I might just return these. Union 2s, I might have a handle on. Not confirmed yet. I don't have in hand, but I might be able to get one of those. I'm still working on that. I was thinking about that drop and how it's been going, and, you know, one thing I realized that Union must have ate so many cancellation and shipping fees, and I know nobody really has sympathy for Union, but if you cancel an order, you still pay the 2.9% to, you know, credit card companies and shipping for every single shoe. They've, you know, instead of charging $40, $50, they made it free. So in my eyes, I think it was a good compromise, but I'm not sure people are going to give them credit for it, you know, because of the seriousness of the mistakes that they made. In terms of misses, I missed on the Kobe 6 Mambacita. It wasn't even available to me here in Canada, so. And, you know, thinking about upcoming shoes, there's not really that many I have in mind. I'm not really interested in these Stussy Air Force One mids. The Ama Manier Jordan 2 looks pretty good, and I see that it was that one has been delayed a bit because of an incident at the store. You know, the main one I'm looking for is the Military 4, and, you know, I've already designated that the shoe of the summer, so if anyone else tries to say that, they got it from me, patent pending. You know, must credit the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast if you declare the Jordan 4 Military Black as the shoe of the summer. You know, people were asking me this week about my thoughts about Trophy Room and how it all blew up on Twitter and stuff in the last few weeks. And my response was really just to kind of point back to my episode 12 on the topic, and that I didn't really have that much more to add. And really, the one to credit for all this is Sneaker Fetish, at Sneaker Fetish on Twitter and on YouTube as well. And his name is Kari, that's what he goes by. And he was the one who had posted some DMs that alleged that Benjamin Kicks and Seattle reseller Chic Shoes and someone else, you know, got like 90% of the shoes and paid $1,500 or so. And, you know, some of those details of what was in those DMs that blew up were a little bit different than what I heard and what I had reported on the podcast. But I can't say that they were wrong because I wasn't there. And even what I had reported myself was more in general terms and not on very specific terms. You know, what's funny was they also kind of restated what I had said in the conspiracy theories episode, that Marcus blew it all in Vegas. And I guess in the replies, there was a confirmation that in his IG stories that, you know, he was in Vegas at the time. And, you know, maybe those stories confirmed it, but I wasn't watching Marcus's IG stories at the time. But if you haven't listened to episode 12 on the topic, I highly recommend it. It was probably one of my better episodes. And, you know, all this news coming out just kind of validated me and my reporting on the subject. And a lot of people had told me privately and also, you know, responding to Akari that I had got the general story right. And, you know, on purpose, I was kind of generally trying to give numbers because I know I don't know specifics. So I gave numbers like, to make the math right, I said, like, say 75% of the stock was backdoored. We know that there's 12,000 pairs, so 75% of that is 9,000 pairs. And so then I said something like, you know, the early numbers were, it was $1,000 each and you had to buy a lot of them. So, you know, like hundreds and hundreds is how I was trying to be general. I had heard the very specific terms, but I can't even recall. And I had said it's possible he only dealt with very few buyers, like a dozen buyers or less. And it makes sense. It's like, if you're going to deal with big numbers, you don't want to deal with a whole bunch of people. You want to deal with a set group that you trust. And even in that episode, I said, I've seen photos where they came in bulk boxes that come from Nike with the red security tape. And at the time, I didn't post those because they weren't my photos to post. And I had said that, you know, people with the most pairs probably aren't flexing or anything like that. You know, and like I said, I gave a general number of, say, 75% was backdoored. But then I also suggested, what if 90% was? What if 10,000 pairs were backdoored? And, you know, I didn't hear anything specific about Benjamin Kicks back then, or any real reseller by name. I haven't really heard anything good about Benjamin Kicks. From what I heard, he was in there late, trying to buy up what he could at the later price of $1,500. And he's not as big of a player as he wants to show that he is. I could be wrong on that, but I'm not there in Florida. But others have called him washed up, which at 22 and being washed up is kind of sad, but you know, he's chosen this lifestyle. So like I said, from what I had heard, the early price was $1,000 a pair. And even that I could be off on. Like, maybe it was $1,100 and then it went up to $1,500. All that matters is the general gist of the story was right. The price was low first and then it went up as, you know, the kind of the market price of the shoe went up. And then more buyers are coming in later to buy from the earlier buyers and things like that. Anyway, so that was a quick recap of episode 12 and what I had said at the time. And so the screenshots Akari had posted alleging some of the same stuff, you know, it kind of followed the same script. Some of the details were off, but these kind of stuff, screenshots and photos, just make it real. They will go viral. They will blow up. And then we saw Marcus quote tweet Akari and, you know, denying it and posting sad Drake lyrics and stuff like that. If he says nothing, it just dies off. It doesn't really blow us up. But he added fuel to the fire and got people going again. So he's the other person to credit for making it blow up. You know, but the real reason that this was even being talked about, that Kari was talking about it, was because, you know, Trophy Room had opened a new store and he was releasing Trophy Room Jordan 1s in this new store as a raffle. And there were allegations that even from that raffle, he was backdooring to known sneaker YouTubers and people who had previously got paired and things like that. You know, I've said on here, YouTube is not my world. That is Kari's world, and he's the one who can speak on it. And that's what he was doing on his Twitter. But, you know, to kind of wrap up this part of the story that I want to talk about, it's like, you know, people will say, what's the end game here? What is the goal here? And really, I didn't have anything. I was just trying to... I am kind of sick of plugging my podcast, which I had already kind of said is what I knew at the time. So my end goal was really just to get these jokes off. And that's what I do on Twitter and stuff. When stuff like this comes up, I try to extract as much joy out of it as I can. You know, I got to retweet all my old jokes and made some new ones. Because, you know what, I know sneaker backdooring is not going to end. It's, you know, that's not my goal, is to kind of expose Marcus. Marcus is untouchable. He's got, you know, diplomatic immunity. I joke that he's just going to say, you know, online is not real life, and get in his Lamborghini Urus and drive away like the 50 Cent GIF. You know, say you work at Nike and you're in charge of an internal inquiry into this matter. And you know, some executive says, good job, Billy. Good report. Now, I want you to go to Michael Jordan and report this to him in person. How's that going to go? What are you going to say to Michael Jordan? Look at God. That's why I had this tweet about the Indiana Jones soldier who has to go get the Holy Grail, and, you know, he gets his head chopped off. And there was a reply that was basically perfect. It said, you know, the penitent man kneels before God. You know, so that is the Trophy Room stuff. But what I really wanted to talk about is kind of the discussion about it and, you know, Complex's thoughts and how they chimed in late and giving credit. You know, last week, Brendan Dunn had tweeted that they had recorded Full Size Run and their podcast before all this Trophy Room stuff blew up, so that they will talk about it the following week, which is this week. And just to be clear, I'm recording this on a Thursday, May 5th, before they usually post on Friday, but I will most likely have this podcast up after they drop, so I just want to make that clear so that I don't know what they're going to say on their Friday podcast. But really, they saw that it blew up and they totally missed a part about why it was being discussed again. You know, it comes across like, hey, why is this a topic again? We already covered this. Because they're not on Twitter. They're not following Kari. They didn't see the backdoor stuff about the new store and all that kind of stuff. They weren't following along on the discussion on Twitter. But they do want to react to the part that did blow up. So it comes across like it's got to be discussed on our terms because we are the ultimate authority on sneakers. Obviously, that's not true. No one needs to wait a week to hear what three white guys have to say on a topic, on a conversation that they weren't even a part of, nor wanted to be. And whatever they post, I'm almost positive they won't credit Kari by name or give his at or anything like that. You know, I can be surprised. Maybe they will. But I've seen them talk shit about Kari before. I've seen subtweets, so I just don't expect it. Same with crediting me on any of the stuff I said about Trophy Room on previous podcasts. They're not going to do that. They're going to credit themselves. And I joked in a quote tweet that this topic should be gatekeeped as a Twitter and Instagram comments only topic. And it was kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek, turning the tables on them being the gatekeepers. Because that's where this topic started. This topic started on Twitter by Kari and kind of blew up from there. And then, you know, a friend of the show, LA3, had a tweet quote tweeting also Brendan saying that, you know, you should get a Sockjig quote from him or his show because he was right about it. And I joked that, you know, they don't really care about anyone from Twitter over there in their BuzzFeed ivory towers. Of course, anyone would like to be acknowledged, but, you know, I know it's not coming and it's not really necessary from them to me. They have either never followed me or did and unfollowed. That means that they actively want to see less info from me. And acknowledging someone else means that you are not the ultimate authority. So they're not going to do that. And mentioning me in any way would help me, so they're not going to do that either. You know, I joked about the ivory towers, and it's, you know, in this kind of field, we either have the ear to the street or the ear to the boardrooms at HQ about sneakers meetings. And that's the kind of stuff that they do well. They cover the history and the business side, and, you know, they cover their friends who are designers really well. They're good at it. They, you know, who so-and-so worked on the Air Zoom Johnson Rod in 1996. They have that knowledge and those friends in the industry versus me, who has no friends in the industry. Actually, let me write that down. That's a good name for a song. But that, you know, that's not entirely true. I do have friends in the industry, but, like, you know, not Ronnie Feig is not my friend. I'm not going to Aspen on ski trips with him. You know, on their podcast, when talking about the Union 2 drop and the issues with it, you know, Joe LaPuma said something like, you know, excuse me for being naive, but was the Union 2 coveted? You know, you're when you're busy hosting sneaker shopping, you're not really aware if people really want the Union 2, I guess. You know, they're capable of it. They could cover what the streets are talking about if they wanted to. They know the right people. But what they don't cover is as instructive as what they do cover. You know, I cover whatever topic I want. I cover topics that they won't cover at all, whether it be resale or conspiracies or country clubs with all their ex-co-workers. You know, I can lob fair criticism at literally anyone, and I'm not sure if they have that kind of freedom themselves. I could even argue that I've covered topics more ethically than they have. You know, they are out there doing editorials and commentary on brands where they have close friendships with, or, you know, they're plugging IG, PS5 raffles, or buying from Benjamin Kicks even. That kind of stuff I would not do with that kind of platform. But I've covered this before. This happens a lot in these kind of industries where you're close with the people you cover, so you got to be cozy with them. It happens with NFL reporting, with gaming, and NFT influencers pumping and dumping as well. You know, they probably don't like me because I criticized them back in March 2020. That was when the pandemic, you know, first started. And at the time, there was this Adidas YouTube series with, you know, Joe LaPuma wearing Superstars, just looking ridiculous, wearing a shoe you know that he's never worn or never really cares for. And at the time, Adidas had some bad press because they were either not closing their stores or not paying their employees, something like that. And I had criticized that this is a bad look because when you have senior editorial writers doing sponsored content for a brand, and if that brand gets bad press, then they can't exactly go out and report on that bad press because they are currently being paid to be in a sponsored content for them. That was the, you know, the crux of my criticism, and it was totally fair criticism. If someone criticized me for that, if I was in sponsored content and something like this happened, I would say something like, yeah, I'm aware it looks bad, but it's kind of touchy having this, you know, Adidas sponsorship and trying to keep editorial separate. You have to kind of lean into it, accept it, and push forward. And they responded to me, actually. They didn't mention me by name, but this is in old podcast. I had to look it up. It was in the Premium Pete episode. They didn't mention me by name, but they called me a troll, and they got totally defensive about it and got it all wrong. They thought I was saying, why are you in this campaign? And acted like that I said that getting paid is bad, and acted as if I didn't know that this campaign was shot months ago and that the timing was just coincidental with the pandemic and the closing of the stores. And of course I know that stuff was shot months ago. That was ages ago. And anyone getting paid, I'm never going to criticize anyone for getting paid because, you know, the motto is the game is the game. But if you are an editor and a writer and a presenter on a show, and then you are also in sponsored content, there are certain ethical duties that you have there. And I understand that it's a fine line to cross those boundaries, but they totally ignored that fair criticism and got defensive about it and called me a troll and stuff. Getting defensive and, you know, not leaning into it just proved that I was right all along. But I haven't seen many branded sponsored content videos from them ever since that, so I'm going to take credit for that. But what I'm saying, and I've said this before, and I think in podcasts the rule is you can tell a story three times. And if I say repeat a story three times, you can just let me know and then I have to cut it off. But after 100 episodes, it gets reset, then I can tell it again. What I'm saying is I'm fine doing what I do. If they talked about what I talk about, then I wouldn't have to talk about it. Any whatever criticism that might be lobbed at me is not going to stick. This is not about clout. This is not about any of that kind of stuff about, you know, gaining followers or whatever. I have as many followers on Twitter or Instagram or listens to the show as I deserve. If I wanted more, I would work for more. If I wanted to game the system, I would be gaming the system. You know, this is a labor of love. The socks and stuff all came later. One thing I could say is I'm not sure any of them would be starting a solo podcast with a gimmick name, without Complex backing, and doing 31 episodes where only two of them were with a guest. You know, I don't mean to be talking shit about them. They're capable and good at what they do. They should keep doing it. I'm capable and good at what I do as well. The Trophy Room episode is proof of that. If you listened, you knew most of the story when all this kind of blew up in the Twitter streets again. You know, they're not going to put me over, but the people put me over. If they're mainstream, then this show is punk rock. You know, Kobe shoes are back, and I'm glad that they're back. I'm glad that they were able to work that deal out. I think in the podcast when I talked about the deal going down, me, like many others, foresaw a future where they would get back and have a deal again. You know, my sense is that it was probably NBA players that pushed hard for it because it's still the number one shoe in the NBA. And I know a lot of players are running out. And if you looked at GOAT on a lot of Kobe shoes, the huge sizes were way higher than all the other sizes because you could probably tell the ball players were buying them up. So last week we saw a coming soon post for the Kobe 6 Bombasita. And they had some copy on there and they talked about exclusive access and how they were going to, you know, give it to the most loyal Kobe fans and to the people who interacted with the app the most and showed the most Mamba mentality. And, you know, a lot of this stuff I thought they got really wrong, especially the voice and tone of the copy itself. It's like if I'm sitting there relentlessly clicking everything, is that Mamba mentality or did I get flagged as a bot? You know, how do they measure who's the most loyal fan? And a lot of it is just copy junk. It's like when you're trying to write an English essay in school, you add a bunch of big words and keep going. And that's what this felt like to me. And I had said, you know, I'm guessing that they were basically dropping what they had. And I know people have the shoe in hand by now, so they can probably see the production dates. I'm guessing most of them were from before the deal was done, because there's no way that they can have 100,000 shoes made, you know, weeks after the deal was re-signed. And it looks like that, you know, the shoes are for Gigi and it's for her birthday. So it was most likely they rushed them out and rushed out what they did have. And the actual drop recap, you know, the Mambacita Foundation site released what they called extremely limited pairs. I know there's stories going around that they only dropped 21 shoes, but I think it was much more than that. They probably had it set up so it wouldn't show exact stock. So a lot of monitors were showing 21, meaning they have 21 different sizes. But whatever it was, like I said on the show before, some small site when they're going to drop like this, you know it's not going to go well because they can't prepare for a drop like this. And especially a shoe like this where there's going to be interest through the roof, it's, you know, most likely just went to bots. And it, you know, they're probably okay with that, I guess. For sneakers itself, they said, you know, early access was going to go out on Sunday at a random time, but really it went at the normal 10 a.m. Eastern time. You know, that was 7 a.m. Pacific for me. I was awake that time, but I bet you there were a ton of people on the West Coast who, you know, woke up late on a Sunday morning, saw that they had exclusive access, and it was all gone by then. You know, I know some sneakers monitors said that there was 93,000 pairs, and, you know, maybe they gave access to 200,000 people and they only had 100,000 shoes. That's why a lot of people, you know, got the whole thing where they couldn't check out. It was because it was probably sold out. And as, you know, you see with this, there is the normal range of emotion, the stages of grief that people go through with a sneaker L, anger and all that kind of stuff. You know, I started writing a Mr. Brightside for it, and it was hard to write because, you know, where can you make jokes on about a charity shoe that a lot of people did hit? The shoe is pretty decent. If I start making fun of the shoe itself, I look like a dick. I will talk about that a little bit later on as well, too. But, you know, looking at the resale price of this shoe just looks way too high. I don't know why the price is this high. I don't know if people were just very excited about the first one and it tails off again. It's just a black shoe. It's got his, you know, daughter's name on it and number on it. If I was going to spend a stack, I would just buy a Grinch, but that's just me. But, you know, we did see the dialogue that people go through about not only battling getting exclusive access and missing on exclusive access and, you know, the sense of entitlement that people can have. But, you know, there was people who were like fantasy dropping the shoe. Like, how would they fantasy drop the shoe? I saw all kinds of good ideas, you know, stuff like a charity auction, you know, make a ton of them, like make Jordan 11 quantities. And like I said, I jumped on that really quickly that I don't think it was even feasible. So maybe in the future, that's what they do. And I hope that it is addressed that way, but I don't know. The other one was like the myth of the pre-order. I have said this before. I'm sure Nike has evaluated doing pre-orders, and I assume that they just see it as not being feasible. There's all kinds of stuff like that. Like, what if they get 2 million pre-orders and they only have enough little plastic heel cups for 200,000 and they can't manufacture more by the date that is reasonable? Like, would you wait a year and a half for a Kobe shoe? Especially if you moved houses and things like that. There's tons of just like logistics and things like that that I'm sure eat away at profit. And it's just way easier to make what you can and drop it. And when you know, make what you can, you also can follow hype formulas and things like that. I will talk about that as well too. But before, I wanted to say, with all this and how I was approaching all this, I was just wanting to be respectful to a widow. You know, above all else, I'm sure she is protecting her family's legacy, protecting her daughter's legacy, her late husband's legacy, all that kind of stuff. When dealing with Nike, I'm sure concessions were made, but I think she did, you know, pretty well from what I can see, with proceeds going to charity and the foundation and all that stuff. And you saw with this shoe, the way that apps got ahead of the story this time, the sneaker apps I'm talking about, like GOAT and StockX. I think GOAT was the first one to announce that they were going to be donating proceeds from this specific shoe to charity, maybe to that same Mombasita Foundation. And I think like StockX and others jumped on board and did the same thing very shortly afterwards. You know, there's a line there as well too. Like, they're doing it for this shoe, but there's been a ton of charity shoes out there. There's been a lot of DB shoes out there, the Dornbecker shoes. And those apps are fine taking the profits from all those shoes. And that's kind of what I want to talk about, is that there's, when you deal with charity shoes and you deal with hype, there is the dilemma that emerges. You can make a lot or you can make a little. If you're making a lot of shoes, it's not going to be as hype. You know, from what I can see, Nike has chosen with the Dornbecker shoes that the vessel is hype shoe, that the choice is to make a few pairs and then get them out there and do charity stuff and events and stuff around it. But the main vessel is not a lot of pairs. Again, that could be because of logistics, or it could be to generate hype and to keep those shoes special. I had the same criticism about the conversation amongst us sneakers that came out from New Balance as well. You know, a sneaker project can be about positive things like, you know, like helping sick kids or representation and a dialogue in black communities. But when it's connected to a hype product, it's still technically about a hype product. And that means making it about an exclusive shoe and generally exclusion as a vessel for that shoe. But when you do that, you are also shielded from criticism because it is for a charity. It is for a good cause. You know, back to Nike and the Kobe line itself. You know, I know this first release was kind of tied to what shoes that were already made before the last deal ran out. So going forward, it's going to be interesting to see what they actually do, not what they actually say. Are they going to increase stock? Are they going to make Jordan 11 quantities? You know, their worry could be if we make a ton and people buy up the first few drops, then will their interest tail off? You know, and the people are saying, at least on Twitter, are saying, you know, don't make it hype. Take it out of that hype cycle and make it a GR because we want a GR Kobe shoe. And Nike's response to that could be to say that the people say that's what they want, but we know, in fact, that's not what they really want. But of course, Nike is not saying that. No one is out there representing Nike saying that. That's why I always say, believe what their actions are and what they do, not what they say in copy on Sneakers App. Okay, I wanted to talk about some recent lawsuits that have been happening in the sneaker industry. You know, I need a fancy label for this, like a lawsuit corner or something. First up was the Mischief versus Vans story. The update was that the judge ordered Mischief to halt all sales and to stop selling them going forward. And I'm pretty sure that they had already sold and shipped all those shoes already. So I'm not sure if the judgment means from that date on or if it means, like, you know, whatever money that they already made has to be held. But if they were smart, they shipped and got all the money for that before the judge made any order. But an update from that was that the creative director for Mischief was on Complex Pod and basically, you know, snitched on himself. And there was a lot of back and forth and a lot of talk about how, you know, kind of Balenciaga does the same thing with ASICS sneakers. But, you know, really Balenciaga is still a fashion brand, whereas Mischief is, you know, still a troll brand because you're called Mischief. And he said something like, you know, he didn't think Vans would sue. And if you dig into this kind of stuff, you should know that Vans actually sues a lot. If you tried to trademark anything that contains the word Vans in it, like Vans Soup or Vans Sweaty or something like that, they will dispute it because it says it has the word Vans in it and there might be market confusion. I'm pretty sure they even, you know, disputed when Geiger first did his GF01 shoe that they disputed that something of that shoe violates their own trade dress. But, you know, if I know Vans sues a lot, then someone working on a potentially infringing product as a creative lead for a company called Mischief should know too, then he should know too. You know, most likely Mischief settles and agrees not to make any more, and that seems to be on par with what they do because they always seem to be on to the next one anyways. But, you know, they got what they wanted. You know, this is what they want. When you're called Mischief, you want to create mischief. Whatever marketing budget they have, they just allocated all that to the lawyer budget. But the one thing I found interesting was the guy, Welty, was on the podcast and he was kind of going back and forth and pushing the guy, you know, rightfully so. And one of the things that he ended up saying was used in the case and was quoted in the case. You know, to get this right here, I wrote it down. What Welty had said was, "Everyone I've spoken to about this shoe says that if someone was walking down the street and I would ask them to tell you what the person across the street was wearing, they'd say they were wearing a pair of Vans." And, you know, he goes on to say more, but the fact that this benchmark or test was, like, quoted and used in case law and could, you know, potentially be used to set precedents, I think is kind of dangerous. I don't think that what does it look like across the street is a good criteria for sneaker infringement. A lot of shoes would fail this test. Rick Owens and Converse or Steve McQueen shoes and Stan Smith. I think all of those would fail. I think it's a fine argument to have for a podcast and it made a good point, but I don't think it should be celebrated as some sort of slam dunk either, especially if it's used to set precedents for future cases. The other story I saw this week was that Nike had settled their lawsuit with La La Land, which was producing Warren Lotus's shoes, some of Geiger's shoes, and something called an Air Jordan 1 Mars Yard, which, you know, looks almost exactly like a sample that Shoe Surgeon had made if you just search Air Jordan 1 Mars Yard. So it's interesting to see if that was actually a Shoe Surgeon shoe or someone ripping him off. Anyway, they agreed not to make any of these shoes. And just a kind of recap of how this all started. This started from Nike suing Warren Lotus, Lotus settling, handing everything over. And in that documentation, it shows that La La Land was the producer. And from there, they see that they were making Geiger shoes and a bunch of other stuff. So I tweeted about this and I even tagged Geiger and saying, you know, I'm not sure if he's still manufacturing there, because if he was, then that would basically shut his shoes down too. But he quote tweeted and replied and said that he's had a different manufacturer for a while now. So he can still produce shoes, but it also means that he is still being sued because his case was separated from the La La Land case. And overall, you know, to transition to Geiger himself, Geiger seems pretty confident on Twitter, at least. And for on Nike's side, my sense is it didn't go as well as they wanted it to. You know, I see some support for Nike saying that these are all knockoffs and things like that, but I don't see a lot of overwhelming support. There's still a lot of Geiger fans out there, and I think Nike kind of thought that maybe he would just fold and just agree not to make any more like La La Land and Warren Lotus did. But, you know, with that said, I wouldn't be surprised if it's settled. Most cases are settled. Nike probably wants to save some sort of face here if, you know, they don't want all their laundry exposed. And that's the thing with Geiger is he does have receipts. He worked at Nike, helped design Darrell Revis shoes and got royalties. You know, I don't think he was an employee there, but some sort of, you know, outside contractor or whatever. So, you know, the terms of whatever the settlement is the key there. Is it going to be that Geiger can't make any more of those shoes anymore, or can he continue to make them? But the other thing I noticed in the series of tweets that he had about Nike was he was taking some shots at Nike designers. And from what it sounds like, from some of his tweets, it sounds like they were taking shots at him and it got back to him. Like, you know, where they were saying that kind of stuff, I don't know. It was probably Slack or something, or in, you know, iMessage. So, you know, there was those famous tweets where Geiger said that the best designers at Nike were Virgil and Kanye. I don't know if that was a response to the designer saying something at Nike or him taking that first shot, you know, the chicken and egg kind of thing. I don't know. But some of those tweets that he had was, I heard that Virgil and Kanye tweet had designers at Nike fighting with each other. He had another one saying it's, you know, kind of crazy that lawyers make more than designers over there. And this is another tweet, quote, funny story. Nike claims they never knew what misplaced checks were, but when Nike goes through my texts and emails for this discovery phase with their key search words, they will find the conversations with Nike designers. End quote. That's what I mean. But he has receipts. And in lawsuit, discovery means when you have to kind of show everything that you have. Show all your plans, all your emails, everything. And what are they going to find there? And if something is damaging there for Nike, Nike will want to settle this and not want it exposed in court. This battle with Geiger and Nike designers, you know, reminded me of another topic I was thinking about. And it's related to the death of Peter Moore as well. Rest in peace, Peter Moore. He was the legendary designer of the Jordan 1, the Wings logo. He co-designed the Jordan 2 along with Bruce Kilgore, who is more famously known as the designer of the Air Force 1. And, you know, the thought I had was there's not any well-known Nike sneaker designers anymore. You know, for this conversation, I'm going to use the term big name sneaker designer, and by that I mean like the Tinker Hatfields, the Bruce Kilgores. So I'm using the term big name instead of celebrity, because celebrity implies like Virgil, Kanye, and collaborators, but really I mean like internal Nike designers that are well known, that have their name out there. You know, other big names from the past that are still working are names like, you know, Stephen Smith or Christian Tresser, who all work for Yeezy now. You know, there's a lot of people that work on a single shoe. It's not just one designer. There's like, you know, color artists and sample people, all that kind of stuff that I don't, you know all the details on. But it would be great if Nike actually put this kind of information out there, like kind of like how on a record album, they show you who exactly the producer and mixer and everything was. but they don't. And that's what I'm kind of talking about here. So, and I noticed that they've been doing it less and less in the last like 2-3 years. Some of the more well-known ones are, of course, the signature basketball sneaker designers. And so I went to news.nike.com. That's their official press release news site. And I looked up the names of the signature basketball designers, and this is what I found. Okay, for the Kobe line, the most well-known designer is Eric Avar. You know, they're obviously not making new Kobe models anymore, but maybe they are starting again, and I don't know if it means that there's going to be future signature lines or not, or just this pro-tro retro kind of stuff. But the last time Eric Avar was mentioned on Nike's new site was 2019 for a Converse ball shoe. It looks like Eric Avar is a VP now, but I don't know if he's still, you know, hands-on and designing in that role either. For the LeBron, it's Jason Petrie. He was last mentioned recently as September 2020 for the LeBron 18. You know, some of these names you'll see, they will do an interview segment with Nick DiPaolo for ESPN or something when they're debuting the newest LeBron shoe or whatever, but that's about it. For Leo Chang, he was last mentioned in 2018. Leo Chang designed the KDs. But from what I looked up, it looks like he has switched to Nike Running now, so he's no longer the lead KD designer. The new KD designer is Ben Nathangcombe, who also worked on the Kyrie 4s, and you know, he did the recent KD 14. You know, Ben has been mentioned in 2019 for the Kyries, and he was last mentioned for the Kyrie 7 on news.nike.com. Nothing about the KD 14. If you search his name, you'll see, you know, something with Nick DiPaolo on, you know, Ball Sack Sports or whatever, wherever he writes. So all this to say is my sense is that Nike's doing this on purpose, that they do not want their names of designers out there and having credit for creating the shoe, especially if there's collaborators involved. And this could possibly be a response to when, you know, in 2014, three top designers at Nike left Nike to go to Adidas. This was a big story in sneakers for, you know, 2-3 years. Those designers were Mark Dolce, Mark Milner, and Dennis Dukovic. So, you know, they crossed the street in Portland to go work at Adidas, but there was a lawsuit because they're saying that those designers violated a non-compete clause. And non-compete is like when you quit somewhere, you cannot go work for a competitor for 1 year. And the lawsuit also said that they took some IP from Nike designs and things like that that Nike owns and took it to Adidas. So actually one thing interesting in that lawsuit from Nike was they alleged that these designers actually bought followers on Instagram and Twitter and that 85% of them are fake and that they were doing this to kind of artificially inflate the perception of their popularity and their credibility. You know, that was in 2014, 2015, whatever, when this lawsuit was going on. But it'd be real interesting to see if Nike actually checks the follower counts of their top designers to see how many are real and how many are fake. That lawsuit was all settled. I think they sat out a year and then they all started in Adidas at 2016. And I'm pretty sure they're still there. I think Dolce might be a VP or something. So I don't know how hands-on he is with sneaker design. So yeah, like I said, I think they kind of realize that having these kind of big names as designers that are, you know, celebs in this field is probably bad for their business, because if they're big and well-known, then they can easily leave for a big check. And obviously, if you're a designer well-known in this industry, you can go get a job somewhere else like Adidas or Under Armour or wherever. Because if you're a rock star in the field, the people in the other, you know, competitor know that. But does the average consumer know that? Not anymore. They knew Bruce Kilgore. They know Tinker Hatfield. But this current generation, do they know any of their names? What if you want to leave Nike and go out on your own? Say have a consultancy business or make an NFT shoe. You got to have your name out there. You got to be a well-known name to do that, to attract the money, the funding, the interest, whatever it is. But if you're not a well-known name, but you worked on big projects and have the resume, you got to put in the work to let people know, look at the work I did. You know, some recent big names that have left Nike has been like Frank Cook. he's kind of probably, he might be the last of the Mohicans in terms of the newer generation of sneaker designers that has a well-known name out there. And he seems to be freelance and working at different places and working on New Balance and all kinds of stuff. Jimo Wong, he's out there. He designed a ton of like stuff, like Supreme stuff, Slam Dunk 6s, Dior, Jordan 1s, Travis and Kaws. And, you know, it's like, did Jimo Wong make that shoe? No. Kaws and Nike made that shoe. Did Jimo Wong make the Travis Scott shoe? No. Travis Scott and Nike made that shoe. So Jimo Wong has to go out there and say, hey, I was there. I helped make those shoes. And, you know, he's a case of someone out there selling some NFT shoe for I don't know who. You know, I mentioned Virgil and being a celebrity designer. Of course, he's not just a celebrity. He was a full-on designer. But, you know, he was not a full-time sneaker designer at Nike. He was a collaborator. You know, there were designers that helped Virgil with the 10 collection and all of his sneakers. In this Harvard lecture, this well-known Harvard lecture that he did, there's a part where he talks about the Presto and the Nike designers who made the first samples. And he calls... And he mentions them by name. He says Matt Kilgore, Nate Jobe, and Enrico. And I think from the Googling I did, that means Enrico Carbonaire, who is a designer at Nike. Anyways, he calls them geniuses for kind of what they did with that Presto, taking an Air Max 90 and kind of turning it inside out and creating a sample for him. You know, the public thinks Virgil did everything because his name is on everything. You know, was he the creative director and gave instructions and the designers implemented the vision? Or were they more full-on collaborators? The one designer, Enrico Carbonaire, there's actually a Nike t-shirt where on the back of it, there's a text conversation between Virgil and Enrico. And they are going back and forth and talking about logos and colors and bigger placement and what it should be. It looks like a full-on collaboration between those two. So, you know, Virgil has mentioned these people in talks and even on a t-shirt at, you know, I don't even know where that was released. It could have been at only at one stop somewhere. And this is back in 2017 when the 10 first dropped. But, you know, Virgil did create this one giant PDF, this 200-page PDF of the 10. And I scanned through that thing. It's mostly pictures, but there's no mention of Matt Kilgore, Nate Jobe, or Enrico Carbonaire. This icons book, the Nike icons Virgil book, I have this, and you know I haven't read obviously every single word written in there, but I skimmed through it. I could not find them credited anywhere. There's even an index in the back, and I looked through every single page of the index, and these are the designers mentioned: Sandy Bodecker, Tinker Hatfield, Toby Hatfield, who is also a designer at Nike and Tinker's son, and Bruce Kilgore, the Air Force One designer. These are all the big, well-known Nike designers. And you know who was not mentioned? Matt Kilgore, who, by the way, is Bruce Kilgore's son. Not mentioned Nate Jobe, and not mentioned Enrico Carbonaire. Even though from what it looks like from this Harvard talk and some of these other talks that are out there, that they worked very closely with Virgil on those shoes. So, you know, as far as the public is concerned, Virgil worked with Nike. He did not work with individual designers at Nike. He worked with Nike. So that's why I say I think the age of this big name designer is over at Nike. If you design at Nike, you didn't design the shoe. Nike did. You are employed by Nike. You can't take it with you. Nike owns it. And if you want to cross the street in Portland to go work at the competitor, you better be prepared to sit out a year. And that's all well and good. That's, you know, well known in the industry. But in this day and age with social media and podcasts, anyone can be a star. Look at me, I got a podcast. Anyone can create a podcast. And that's why, you know, they've exploded in these last 4 years because everyone wants to be a star. There's always going to be a social media star. So if you're a Nike designer and say you want to be a big name, you know, the point is there's more options now. And, you know, not to say that everyone wants to be a star. If your dream is to work at Nike and you love it, great. Work at Nike. If you don't have the personality to have your name out there and want to be a star and you just want to do the work, great. If you're good at it, you will be employed. But you know, I can speak personally, working at a big company is not always as great as it seems. you know, looking from the outside and what goes on with some Nike lawsuits about working there, it doesn't seem like the greatest place to work at from my point of view. You know, those gates at HQ there, they keep people out, but they also keep you in. And big companies, if there's a giant stack of resumes sitting at HR, then they treat their current employees like there's a giant stack of resumes sitting at HR to replace you. And Nike's had this exodus of talent. A lot of the talent, the designers and stuff that worked at ACG have moved to Yeezy. The Nate Job I mentioned, who worked with Virgil, he left to work at New Guards Group. And there's been several others. So, you know, what's the answer to this? If you're Nike, you know, I would suggest paying people better, paying them more. Obviously, you probably can't pay what lawyers get paid, but if you're the market leader, you got money. You can also give credit. I think a lot of people, a lot of designers would love having credit. Who doesn't want to have credit? I want to have credit. But for the designers themselves, they got to get themselves over with the crowd if they want to be out there after. They got to think about their career post-Nike. You know, while you work at Nike, you can't go talk to the press. Everything has to be, at big companies, everything has to go through a PR department. Because they don't want some random person saying something and the PR people don't even know about it and it's in the news and they got to react. So that's how big companies operate. Everything has to be authorized. It's authorized when Nick DiPaola talks to Eric Avar for Ball Sack Sports. In the same vein, it's tricky. You can't express opinions about your employee either. Otherwise, people will think it's official word of Nike. That's why you see these disclaimers in bios that my opinions do not reflect my employer. But with all those constraints, you got to get yourself over with the crowd. You got to use Instagram more. You got to get your friends to credit you, to congratulate you when the shoe that you worked on is out there. You have to be your own active agent in getting your name out there and getting the recognition out there. Sure, Brendan Dunn will name drop you in an episode, but is that enough? Probably not. You probably got to do more than that because one thing for sure is Nike isn't going to put your name out there. This has been episode 31 of the Sock Jig Sneaker Podcast. Thanks for listening. And you know, talking about giving credit and getting your name out there, one thing I want to make sure to get out there is that you should go fuck yourself.